We'll hear argument first this morning in number 87-1064, United States versus Philip George Stewart. Mr. Wallace, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. This is a proceeding to enforce internal revenue summonses for bank records in a bank in Bellingham, Washington, that reflect accounts of two Canadian nationals. The summonses were issued pursuant to a request by Canada under a tax treaty between Canada and the United States that provides, among other things, for exchanges of information to assist each other in the administration of their tax laws. The United States has such treaties in force currently with 34 countries. They're collected in footnote 17 on page 41 of our brief. And these treaties play an important role in the Internal Revenue Service's broad authority to investigate compliance with our internal revenue laws by providing the IRS, through reciprocal exchanges, with foreign source information that would not otherwise be available to the IRS. The two most pertinent articles of the treaty are set forth at the beginning of the appendix to our brief on page 1A of the appendix following page 48 of our brief. And the court will note that Article 19 provides that the competent authorities, the executive branch officials designated to administer the treaties, will exchange information that is at their disposal or that they are in a position to obtain. And information may be exchanged directly between the competent authorities of the two contracting states. And Article 21 says that the commissioner may, upon request, furnish our treaty partner with information that the commissioner is entitled to obtain under the revenue laws of the United States. These are fairly typical, and they obviously contemplate, in appropriate cases, the use of a process to obtain records that are not already in the possession of the tax authorities in each state. And indeed, the legislative history of the particular treaty involved here, as we set forth on page 29 of our brief, shows that during the confirmation process, and that's in footnote 11 and the accompanying text, it was contemplated in the Senate that a process such as an internal revenue summons would be used to secure information for each treaty partner. And the specific reference that was made there was to the obtaining of bank records. And in 1975...
Mr. Wallace, excuse me, may I just interrupt you? Maybe I'm not seeing something here, but the treaty says information which its competent authorities are in a position to obtain under its revenue laws, right? And you rely on Section 7602. But as I read 7602, it only authorizes summons for purposes of determining United States tax liability.
Well, that is
so how can you say that you're in a position to obtain it under our revenue laws when you're not seeking to ascertain United States tax liability?
That is a certainly a possible reading of 7602, and that very question was debated and decided in the 1975 Second Circuit case that we have cited in our brief, United States against A.L. Burbank Company, in which this court denied certiorari. The contention was made there that the summons authority conferred by Congress was not sufficiently broad to obtain information regarding compliance with the treaty partners' revenue laws, notwithstanding the broader perspective that I tried to give the court, that this it looked at overall becomes a means of getting reciprocal information that the IRS could not otherwise get about compliance with the American tax laws. And the Second Circuit held in that case that 7602 should not be interpreted more narrowly. Not only did this court deny certiorari, but Congress since has amended 7602 without disturbing that provision, and a large number of these treaties have since been entered into in presumed reliance on this interpretation. At the time of the Burbank decision, the Second Circuit stated that there were 19 such treaties then in effect. There are now 34 such treaties in effect. So the Burbank decision, we submit, was not only a correct interpretation at the time, but it has been built into the fabric of the law, and as in many other instances, if possible, a statute should be interpreted in a way that helps to effectuate the purposes of a treaty, which is also the supreme law of the land.
You don't have any language that would allow that, though, do you? I mean, the language seems quite clearly
to
say.
We have no language.
What's the closest phrase you have that would allow it to be read this way?
I don't have a phrase that looks specifically to investigation of compliance with Canadian or other countries' revenue laws, but I do think the broader perspective that I have mentioned, that these reciprocal obligations are a method by which the Internal Revenue Service is enabled more successfully to conduct its own investigations, is highly pertinent, along with what we submit is congressional acquiescence in this interpretation, not only reflected in amendments of 7602, but in the confirmation of these numerous treaties that look toward the use of compulsory process.
If you did not have the summons authority, the treaty wouldn't necessarily be a nullity, would it?
Not necessarily.
Because the government still has information that it can furnish.
It has information, although a similar argument could be made about the service's authority to conduct any investigation or engage in any operations. It's all part of Chapter 78 of the Internal Revenue Code, which includes Chapter 7602. And, of course, all authority that the service has to investigate is replete with references to our revenue laws. So I'd have to say that a similar argument could be made about furnishing any information under the treaty, that a question could be raised about the service's statutory authority. So the summons question is not unique in that respect.
Did the Ninth Circuit expressly consider the summons question in its opinion in this case?
It did not expressly discuss this question, but it accepted the holding in the Burbank case. I mean, its holding is that a summons can be used for this purpose if the service complies with a requirement that it added with respect to an analog to a referral to the U.S. Department of Justice. So implicit in its holding is acceptance of the Burbank decision. Indeed, one could argue that in the absence of a cross petition, that question is not open because it would change the relief in a manner more favorable to the respondents here. because the Ninth Circuit ordered a remand that does not preclude enforcement of the summons if that condition can be complied with by the Revenue Service. So as a technical matter, the question really is not open before the court in this case. But we do submit that the Burbank decision is part of the fabric of the law now. It should not be repudiated by this court, and it plays an important role in our foreign relations. What the Court of Appeals did do in this case was put itself in conflict with a later 1983 Second Circuit decision called United States Against Manufacturers and Traders Trust Company, by holding, that is the Ninth Circuit holding, that the supporting affidavits in this case did not make a prima facie showing that the summonses were issued for a legitimate purpose because they failed to state that the Canadian investigation had not reached a stage analogous to referral to the U.S. Justice Department for a grand jury investigation or for criminal prosecution. And Section 7602C prohibits the issuance of a summons by the IRS when such a referral to the U.S. Justice Department is in effect. Now, in adding this requirement, we think that the Court of Appeals here erred on two principal grounds. The first is that the treaty clearly contemplates that the question whether the treaty partner has made a proper request is to be determined by the executive branch official designated to administer the treaty, referred to in the treaty as the competent authority. As we have explained in our brief, most of the information that is actually exchanged under these treaties is provided directly by the competent authority without any other entity, judicial or otherwise, of the government being involved. A typical example is compilations of dividend payments by various American corporations to foreign nationals and reciprocal information from the foreign country. In many instances, the rate of withholding is lower for dividend payments to foreign nationals than it would be under the Internal Revenue Law for a dividend payment to an American. And the corporations will provide the IRS with a list of the foreign nationals for whom the lower withholding rate provided for by treaty has been utilized, and the IRS, without any particular request even from our treaty partner, will provide compilations of that information to the treaty partner. Much of the information that is exchanged without any particular request and without any use of process. Now, in those instances where a summons is used to secure information not already in the hands of the IRS, the summons enforcement proceeding, we submit, which is summary in nature, this court has emphasized many times, should not inject the courts into this aspect of treaty administration in making or second-guessing the determination ordinarily made by the competent authority and by the executive branch about whether the request by the treaty partner is a proper request under the treaty. This is the kind of question that involves sensitive foreign policy considerations. There quite obviously would be sensitivity to having a court inquiry focusing on the good faith of the treaty partner in making a request for information under the treaty, in which the courts would be re-examining and perhaps second-guessing the determination made by the executive branch official.
May I interrupt you, Mr. Wallace? I don't really understand that argument, because if you have an objective test of whether there's been a reference to for prosecution or not, why does that involve any inquiry into good faith?
Well, this court, starting with United States against Powell, has characterized the inquiry to be made in these summons enforcement proceedings as an inquiry into the IRS's good faith in issuing the summons. And good faith is largely translated into whether it's for a legitimate statutory purpose, whether the proper procedures have been followed, whether the information may be relevant, as the court said, compliance with the Internal Revenue laws, whether there is a collateral purpose such as harassing the taxpayer or trying to put pressure on the taxpayer to settle a collateral dispute. Those are elements of good faith which arguably could arise in inquiring into the legitimacy of the treaty.
But why couldn't you just presume that there was good faith in all matters of that kind and still say you got to follow the American rule that there has been no reference for criminal purposes yet? Just have a simple black-letter rule to that effect. That wouldn't question the motives of the foreign treaty partner, would it?
Well, it would question the legitimacy of their normal investigative process.
Oh, to just say that's our rule on subpoena enforcement. We have this rule, and it doesn't, therefore, the treaty isn't complied with.
If the treaty or a statute had specified that, I can't argue that that would be an open-ended invitation for the courts to examine good faith. But what this court's line of decisions has indicated is that it is the good faith of the IRS in asking that a summons be enforced that is the proper subject of investigation in a summons enforcement proceeding, not the merits of the investigation. The Powell decision, which is the seminal decision in 379 U.S., made that very clear with respect to two issues that the taxpayer sought to have reexamined that went to the merits of the investigation, two rather discrete issues, one because the statute of limitations had expired except for fraud, whether there was a sufficient basis to conduct the investigation because there was a sufficient basis to suspect fraud, and the other was whether the commissioner had properly certified that an additional inspection of records was necessary, which had to be certified under the statute when there had already been one inspection of records. And the court held that neither of those aspects of the merits of the investigation is something to be raised in the summons enforcement proceeding, that instead it has to be limited to the kinds of issues that I had adverted to a bit earlier. And as recently as the court's unanimous decision in the Tiffany Fine Arts case in volume 469 U.S., the court again reemphasized when the taxpayer complained that the IRS was unnecessarily investigating too many licensees under the scheme that was at issue there. And I may quote the court, "The decision of how many and which licensees to contact is one for the IRS, not Tiffany, to make," and one might add, not the court, in the course of a summons enforcement proceeding.
Mr. Wallace, you're suggesting that this statute would apply against a United States citizen as well. It's not just a citizen of a foreign country, right? I mean, the treaty would cover a United States citizen who is asserted to be liable for foreign taxes.
Yes, correct? It would.
So a United States citizen who is being harassed by a foreign government, that foreign government can enlist our government in that harassment without any possibility of our courts stopping it.
With respect to the summons enforcement proceeding, what could be shown is that the IRS was not acting in good faith because the IRS did not consider this a proper request under the treaty, but was lending itself to a scheme of harassment concerning information that has no possible relevance to tax.
But you're taking the position the IRS doesn't have to inquire into that. That's part of your whole point, that you don't want our IRS to have to inquire into whether they're is harassment going on, or the good faith of the foreign government? Do you want the IRS to have to do that?
I would not want to mislead the court into thinking that the IRS rubber stamps every treaty request for information, even information that is on hand. But under the treaty, it's the competent authority at the IRS who makes the determination of whether that is a proper request. But
I think that's an extraordinary thing for to have United States courts engaging in that, and I think it's a hard question. Maybe if Congress had passed a statute covering this matter, it might have given some thought to that question.
Well,
but since it hasn't, you're really sort of asking us to make it up.
If I may say so, Mr. Justice, what makes it seem less extraordinary to us is that the summons enforcement proceeding, the attempt to interfere with the investigation, is not the ordinary place in which the merits of summonses for third-party records is debated. It's usually debated not in that summary context, but later on when there's an effort to use the information against an individual. And here, if there is something that does not comply with the rights of Canadian taxpayers, the defense would ordinarily be raised in the Canadian courts. That's where Canadian law would ordinarily be debated. In Donaldson against the United States, in volume 400, the court held that the taxpayer did not even have standing to intervene in a summons enforcement proceeding in which the IRS was trying to get third-party records relating to the taxpayer's liability. In that case, records of his former employer. And it is sometimes mistakenly thought that Congress overruled the Donaldson case. Congress has left that holding in Donaldson entirely untouched for the category of third-party records that was involved there, employer records or records of a former employer. That is still good law. The taxpayer cannot even be heard during the summons enforcement proceeding.
I'm somewhat puzzled, however, because in your answer to Justice Scalia's question, you said, well, the IRS does give itself some assurance that the other country is acting in good faith, yet I thought that's exactly what you're telling us we can't require you to do.
You can, in the summons enforcement proceeding, the question is the IRS's good faith rather than.
I understand that, yes. That's your position, but the question was put to you, suppose a country is harassing someone, say, for his political views. And the IRS is in good faith. It knows that the country wants the material. But you say the IRS does make some investigation on the merits of the request?
It does consider whether the request is a proper one under the treaty. That is correct. But in most instances...
Well, is it a proper request under the treaty if the country is harassing someone for their political views?
That would... That would depend on whether there is also a legitimate basis for the request that complies with the terms of the treaty. Not every country with which we have a treaty has our system of government. You'll notice that among the 34 countries, there are several communist states. The political branches of our government have determined
that well, it's still not clear to me when you examine into the motives of another country and when you don't. And if you indicate that you do, I thought that's exactly what what the Ninth Circuit held that you should do and that you're arguing against.
Well, the Ninth Circuit held that the enforcement court should examine those motives. In determining whether to honor a request under a treaty, we're dealing with a sensitive area of foreign relations that is ordinarily a matter for the executive branch and those conducting our foreign relations, and not a matter to be debated courtroom by courtroom. And in most instances, this determination, whether to furnish the information or not, is dispositively made by the executive branch officials. There is no mechanism whereby the courts could ordinarily interfere with the furnishing of that information, regardless of whether some people might think that the particular government might be harassing particular people. That has been something taken into account in negotiating and determining to comply with these treaties. I just want to advert very briefly to our second major point, which is that neither the treaty nor the statute contains the substantive restriction that the Court of Appeals here added, this search for an analog to reference to the United States Justice Department. And we submit that it is a wholly inappropriate addition because that search reflects considerations entirely of domestic law that do not fit very well, if at all, to any of the foreign systems of law enforcement that we're involved with here. This is a little like arguing to the court that the sun does not revolve around the earth. Foreign systems are quite different, and what was reflected in the series of cases in which this was developed was an effort by the court and then by Congress to reconcile the IRS's broad investigative authority with the normal rules governing criminal discovery and grand jury subpoenas so as to not have a different rule in criminal cases applying for criminal tax cases than the normal rule applying for other prosecutions. I would like
Mr. Wallace, do you remember what the earliest treaty like this was?
I could not say, Mr. Justice. I'd like to reserve the balance of my time, if I may.
Very well, Mr. Wallace. And Mr. Perry, we'll hear now from you.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, the issue here respondents submit is whether domestic law limits upon IRS summons authority are expanded by the treaty with Canada, which is the subject of these cases. Should the IRS be required to comply with domestic revenue laws of the United States when it asks the courts to lend their process and their authority to enforce an IRS summons for the purpose of obtaining information for a foreign government? Under a specific treaty, which incorporates and by reference and defers to the revenue laws of the United States of America, respondents submit that the answer properly is the one given by the Ninth Circuit in these consolidated cases below.
Mr. Perry, the subsections, I guess you're talking about 7602C and so forth, speak of the Justice Department, which surely refers to the United States Justice Department, doesn't it?
Yes, there are cross-references in Articles 19 and 21 to the departments of the two governments. Revenue Canada is referred to specifically, and the Commissioner of the Internal Revenue in the United States is referred to specifically, but both of them, both of those sections, 19 and 21 of the treaty, refer to the domestic laws, revenue laws of each of the countries, and that's what gets us to Section 7602.
Yes, but how do you get from Section 7602's reference to the Justice Department to a kind of a renvoi-type reference to the to Canadian procedure? We don't know that the Canadian Justice Department plays the same role in collection of Canadian taxes that the our Justice Department does.
Actually, in these cases, I believe we do now know something about the method and approach of the Canadian Tax Authority and their interrelationship with the Canadian Department of Justice, and it is very much like the system in the United States. So the burdensome inquiry that the government has raised, I submit, really does not apply to this case. In the supplemental brief that we filed, we refer to an international tax article which appeared just last month, which quotes from a section of the operations manual of Revenue Canada, instructing its agents specifically how to act with respect to requests for information from the IRS in the United States. And in that instruction, it specifically says that the summons authority of the IRS in the United States may not be used after a referral to the Department of Justice for prosecution, and further instructs its revenue agents that if they want information from the United States, they must ask for it under summons prior to their own referral to their own Justice Department.
And you think our interpretation of our law should be governed by Revenue Canada?
No, sir. I was just saying.
I mean, why? I'd much rather have it governed by our Justice Department than by Revenue Canada if it comes to that.
It ought to be governed by the totality of the revenue laws of the United States, which is what the treaty requires, and which incorporates certainly 7602 and its procedures and
the other. You bring before us one case out of however many treaties Mr. Wallace said there were, in which it may be easy to analogize the revenue system of the country in question with that of the United States. But I doubt whether it's possible with a lot of the other countries, and certainly in determining whether the rule you're urging upon us is a rule that can possibly have been intended. It's relevant whether we know anything about the internal revenue systems of these other countries. Just because you pick one country that we might doesn't justify us in adopting the rule you're suggesting.
Well, Your Honor, we have a specific factual situation in this case, and I intend to address the broader rule that this Court is certainly interested in, but we have a specific treaty with Canada.
The Philippines, for example. Do we have a treaty with the Philippines?
I don't know that.
They're all listed in the book.
But I
pick the most exotic country that's listed in
probably
Mr. Wallace's footnote. Right. Now, how are we supposed to behave with respect to a referral requirement from such a country?
We point to the treaty with that country, which refers specifically to the domestic tax revenue law of the United States, and we tell that country, or ask the IRS to tell that country, that when you make a request of the IRS for information which may require our summons power, then tell us, certify to us, that you do not presently have a criminal prosecution matter pending in this instance for which you are asking for this information. I think we can reduce it to, if we need to one question. The Ninth Circuit below posed two questions because they were dealing with a specific treaty and a specific country, Canada, and the government had said and admitted before the Ninth Circuit below that it had that information and could have supplied it and would have.
But you see, you have two different organizations in this country. One does the IRS investigation, the other does the criminal investigation. What if you're dealing with a country where there's just one unit that does all investigations? If it conducts the investigation, and if it digs up enough stuff to prosecute criminally, it prosecutes criminally. It's meaningless to have this referral distinction in such a country could never say there's no criminal investigation pending because there's no distinction between a criminal investigation and an IRS investigation.
Perhaps I misspoke, Your Honor. I believe I said criminal prosecution. I make that distinction as a very important one. The functions of criminal investigation and civil investigation are mixed in our system, and they are abroad. They certainly are in Canada. But the distinction really should be between investigation and prosecutorial function. And the test, the question that the Ninth Circuit has posed, the two questions, which I've reduced perhaps to one, is a certification of whether or not there's a pending criminal prosecution matter.
But what does that mean when you come to apply it? Does it mean that a complaint or whatever, an indictment, whatever might be filed in the Philippines, has been filed in court?
Well, I'm not asking the court system or the IRS to investigate, although they say that they do look into the motivations of the requesting country.
But
perhaps that's a question for another.
Yeah, but what I meant to ask you was, you say, is there a criminal prosecution? You put that, it seems to me, as if that's a very definite type of standard. But really, what does it mean? Does it mean are authorities investigating with the possibility of filing what would correspond to an indictment? Or is there an indictment already filed? Which of those?
Well, we not only have problems of differences in countries' approach to these matters, but differences in language. But I think that a treaty partner asking us for information in this country ought to educate themselves about the difference between prosecution and investigation and should be able to comply with that request.
Well, in this country, it's one function is in one division and another function is in another division. But as Justice Scalia points out, in a country where they don't have that separation of functions, the question really would be very difficult to answer, I would think.
Well, I believe it is. There are difficulties in administering treaties, but the focus here, as these cases arise procedurally and come before this court, is that the courts of this country, the Federal District Court, in this case, is being asked to lend its process and its authority to the enforcement of a summons to get information from another country under a treaty which specifically refers to the domestic revenue laws of the United States. And I think the answer is that we tell our treaty partners that these are the requirements under the domestic revenue laws of the United States, that there not be a pending criminal prosecution matter for which this information is requested, and they should comply. We must do the same with respect to asking for information from Canada. The briefing indicates that we defer to Canada's interpretation of their own procedural requirements and comply with it when the IRS asks for information from Revenue Canada.
What would the Canadians or the Philippine government, say the Philippine government, do if they have a single unit that investigates both civil and criminal matters and they're simply studying the file? Is that a pending prosecution?
It doesn't sound like it to me. But again, I would require the treaty partner to comply.
But it's your test, and if you can't even explain to us how the government should answer under its test, then it's not a very strong test.
Well, it is, because the entire body of United States law makes a very important distinction between civil and criminal matters. There are protections available to the individuals in our country in criminal matters that don't exist in civil. It's an important concept in the law of the United States, and the law of the United States is incorporated into the treaty. And I think we have a right, because the language is there in the treaty, to require the treaty partner to understand enough about our system to be able to use that distinction in its request for information. I admit it's not an easy test, but I think the way to do it is to refer to the domestic revenue law of the United States, as the treaty does.
Mr. Puri, I guess you are not arguing to us here that under this treaty that the only information sought can be information relevant to an inquiry concerning an internal revenue tax of the United States. You're not making that argument.
Well, I think there was support at the time the Burbank case was argued for the position that absent a specific authorization to the IRS to acquire information for a foreign government, none exists. I think that.
But you are not making that argument to us.
I'm not, because my understanding was the certiorari was denied in the Burbank case, and we've not raised that specific argument, although I believe there's merit to it.
And the court below did not, of course, rest its holding on that matter?
No, it assumed, as Mr. Wallace has pointed out, that under the Burbank case and others, that the summons authority of the IRS could be used to meet its obligations under the treaty.
Of course, certiorari deny doesn't mean we agree with it necessarily.
That's true, Your Honor. Again, I feel there are substantial arguments in support of the proposition that absent a specific authority to use the summons for this purpose, none exists. But certainly that gets us into the interpretation of treaties to effectuate their purpose.
You're not raising the argument, so just in case I might disagree with Burbank, you're asking me to imagine what kind of authority I think the United States would have if the United States had authority. That's what you want me to tell you.
The question was asked earlier by the court of Mr. Wallace. Would the treaty be a nullity without the summons authority of the IRS? And I believe Mr. Wallace answered no. So the issue is raised in questioning by the court. Respondents submit that the Ninth Circuit's opinion below in these consolidated cases is supported by the language of the treaty contract, the actual practice of the treaty partners, and the language and purposes of the subsequent tax treaties between the United States and Canada, that is the 1980 treaty and the 1985 treaty, specifically for the purpose of aid in criminal tax matters. All of them require the application of the domestic United States revenue laws. Secondly, a legitimate purpose showing is required under United States revenue laws. And thirdly, use of an IRS summons for the specific purpose of criminal prosecution is specifically rejected by the courts in the cases and by Congress in the TEFRA amendments, making that that use not a legitimate purpose. Fourth point that I would like to make is that the IRS has admitted that it is its customary practice in domestic cases in applying to the courts for enforcement of their summons to state that there has been no referral for criminal prosecution. So it's a matter of customary practice in domestic cases. And again, the treaty refers to the domestic law and practice in the United States. Fifth, I submit that the result of the Ninth Circuit's holding is fair with respect to the balancing of the interest between the individuals and the IRS. It's practical in application, it's efficient, and it promotes uniformity between domestic practice and the tax treaty case information requirements. I submit that the...
May I ask on your view of the matter, do you think it requires an inquiry into the good faith of the Canadian taxing authorities?
No, sir. Not at this stage, although this court in LaSalle, certainly for domestic purposes, has left open the area of institutional good faith. Again, domestic cases.
Well, and if we're talking about a domestic matter and we were persuaded there was bad faith on the part of the IRS, even though the matter had not yet been referred for
some other kind of bad faith,
that would defeat the summons enforcement, would it not?
Yes, and it should, and that's a proper area of inquiry.
Well, then why should it not also defeat it in the Canadian context?
Well, I believe that...
If you're saying the same law applies to both...
Sure, and I believe that's true. It should.
So
think
therefore,
it's a proper area of inquiry if there's a showing which fairly raises the issue of bad faith.
You would require... I see. But if there were a... if the burden is on the taxpayer or the person resisting the summons, why has that burden been discharged in this case then?
Because I think there's a difference. The clearly prohibited purpose of using IRS summons for in support of criminal prosecution is a different matter. I mean, it has been discussed by Congress. It's been discussed by this court and other courts repeatedly. And everybody agrees, it's unanimous, that use of the IRS summons for criminal prosecution purposes
but,
is
but prohibited. Why shouldn't it be on the taxpayer's burden or the person raising the issue's burden to say it is being used for such a purpose in Canada? There's no showing either way, as I understand it, in this
That's
case.
Right. We have no information. And the Ninth Circuit, I think, pointed out the real problem. It's a dilemma. It's a catch-22 for the taxpayer at that point. because there's no discovery available to get the kinds of information which would be necessary to meet that burden of proof on the taxpayer, whereas the IRS said below that it had that information. It was given an opportunity to amend its affidavit in support of summons application, and it chose not to do that. This case would have been long over had the IRS gone back, amended its affidavit to show the answers to those two questions that the Ninth Circuit posed. Has it been referred in Canada to the Department of Justice in Canada, or is Revenue Canada asking for this information on behalf of the Department of Justice, the criminal prosecution arm?
Mr. Perry, does the record show why these Canadian citizens had American bank accounts?
No, sir, and I have no idea. I was not involved at that point. There's no record to show why.
They're your clients, aren't they?
Yes, sir.
But you have no idea?
No. Of course, there's no prohibition against Americans having bank accounts in Canada either. It happens frequently, and of course, there's a great deal of commerce between the two countries. Corporations have accounts in both countries.
Well, they might have been doing business in this country at one time, set up an account and just kept it, but
that's what I would assume.
Nothing like that on the record.
No, but there's a lot of commerce between Washington State and British Columbia, which is where this factual situation arises, and I would assume that these were commercial matters at one time, may still be.
But you don't know.
I do not know that, sir. I submit that the Ninth Circuit's reading of the language of the specific tax treaty, 1942 treaty, which it found applies here, is the correct one. That Article 19 refers specifically to the revenue laws of the two contracting states, the United States and Canada. It does not refer to the criminal tax laws or the criminal case law of either country. It's specifically aimed at the revenue laws of the two nations. Article 21 specifically describes the procedures for requests by the Canadian Minister of the Department of National Revenue, and specifically talks about the kinds of information which may be furnished by the Commissioner of the Internal Revenue Service of the United States in the following language: such information as the Commissioner is entitled to obtain under the revenue laws of the United States of America. I submit that that language could not be plainer, that the intent when the Department of Revenue or Revenue Canada asks the IRS for information is controlled by what is available to the IRS Commissioner under the revenue laws of the United States of America. They include Section 7602, which was the basis for the IRS petition below for summons enforcement in these consolidated cases. And 7602 sub C prohibits issuance of a summons and the beginning of any action to enforce any summons if a Justice Department referral is underway. This is a codification by Congress in the TEFRA amendments in 1982 of that bright line test that the minority suggested in the LaSalle National Bank case from this court in 1978. It was intended, I submit, to distinguish between the civil revenue purposes, which are proper areas for investigation by the IRS, a legitimate purpose, and criminal prosecution, which is not a legitimate purpose.
Why is it the United States is concerned as to how Canada goes about investigating tax delinquencies there?
Well, I think it need not be concerned at this point. Certainly in these cases, it only is appropriate to apply the domestic revenue laws of the United States when the treaty partner Canada asks for information. And it's been very important in the development of the case law and the code by Congress for guidance of the Internal Revenue Service that there be a clear dichotomy in the Revenue Service's activities between criminal prosecution, which is not authorized, and civil investigation.
That dichotomy has obviously been enacted in the TEFRA amendments, but why should it carry over to our concern for the relationship between the Canadian government and a Canadian taxpayer?
I'm not urging that we be concerned, except insofar as Canada might be harassing a United States citizen with respect to the use of its revenue department and asking the IRS to lend its weight to that. I'm not that is not the focus of the respondent's argument and point here. The focus is that the domestic revenue laws of the United States apply, and if a treaty partner asks for something within the United States and the IRS to get it with its summons authority, it has to comply with domestic United States revenue law.
So you say that that language can be only read in one way. I think my point is that if the language isn't quite as clear as you think, it doesn't make much policy sense to adopt your suggestion if the other one is equally plausible under the language.
Well, I think we certainly ought to be reluctant to make an inquiry into the domestic affairs of a foreign government, a treaty partner. I agree with Mr. Wallace about that, but I'm saying that the test and approach applied by the Ninth Circuit does not require that, and that's not this case. The Revenue Service admitted below that it had information from Revenue Canada that they had not referred the matter to the Department of Justice in Canada and that they were not asking for the information on behalf of the Department of Justice. So it would not, in these cases, have required any kind of investigation into the internal workings of Revenue Canada or its Department of Justice. I submit that the 1980 treaty, which was ratified somewhat after the LaSalle case, actually served to apply the judicial laws, that is, the entire body of the revenue law of the United States, and referred to it quite specifically. The government concedes in its brief on page 4, footnote 3, that the language and purpose of the 1980 treaty are essentially identical to the language and purpose of the 1942 treaty, and its purpose is to obtain information for each of the parties in the same way as if its own taxation were involved. So there's another referral specifically in the 1980 treaty to the domestic revenue law of the country who is being requested to provide the information. Subsection 3 of Article 27 provides, with respect to the process that of construction of that treaty, that the preceding paragraphs are to be construed so as to impose an obligation. They're not to be construed, I'm sorry. So as to impose an obligation to supply information not obtainable under the laws or in the normal course of administration of either of the contracting states.
Mr. Perry, can I interrupt you there for just a second? These banks that have the information, the bank, or the one bank, I guess, isn't it, in somewhere in Washington, is an American bank.
Yes, sir.
And the Canadian citizens have an account in the American bank.
Yes, sir.
Now, isn't it possible that those Canadian citizens would have an income tax obligation in the United States by reason of interest earned on that account or something like that?
It is possible, but there was no domestic revenue purpose indicated.
Well, but at least it would be permissible, would it not, for IRS to say, I'd like to check the bank records there to see if these foreign citizens might owe some federal taxes.
Certainly.
And if so, that information would be obtainable purely for domestic purposes pursuant to the United States statute.
Certainly, and it can even be a mixed purpose.
Why isn't that the whole answer to the case?
Well, it's not, because of the court's concerns and the Congress concerns about that important dichotomy between civil and criminal. And
but there's no criminal, but if they're just looking at American purposes, there's not even a suggestion that there's been any American referral for to the Department of Justice.
That's true, and if that had been the basis for the inquiry,
Well, it hadn't been the basis, but it could be done pursuant to American law, is what I'm saying.
Yes, it
for
could.
Just that limited purpose.
The problem arose because the information that was furnished indicated clearly that the authority for the inquiry that the IRS was using was the tax treaty with Canada and Section 7602. And there was an indication that that Canada was investigating for criminal purposes, creating certainly an ambiguity that needed to be explored, and we only asked for the information that the Ninth Circuit required the IRS to provide on remand. I submit that another reason for the interpretation, in support of the approach of the Ninth Circuit is that, and against the manufacturer's trust holding by the Second Circuit is, that there's no justification in the body of the law or the treaty or in reason to create a separate set of entitlements for the IRS commissioner to use, a legal fiction, I submit, in order to get information from a foreign country in the United States in a manner which exceeds the authority for domestic purposes. In our supplemental brief, we've referred to the 1985 Treaty on Mutual Legal Assistance in Criminal Matters, and I submit that that evidences the acknowledgement by the treaty partners, Canada and the United States, of the important distinction between criminal prosecution matters and civil tax revenue matters, and that treaty is now before the United States Senate for ratification. It sets up a separate system and approach for the sharing of information in those matters which are criminal tax matters, and I submit quite appropriately. It uses the Departments of Justice to exchange information, and it is within the context and framework of the criminal law protections that exist for the citizens of this country. And I think I would urge that what we see from that is that that the executive, at least on one hand, agreeing with Congress and with the opinions of the courts, is now saying that if it's a criminal prosecution matter, we ought to call it that, have a separate procedure for handling it as a criminal prosecution, and proceed that way. The Ninth Circuit's approach and the requirement on the IRS to make a prima facie showing of a legitimate purpose, including the absence of the prohibited purpose of criminal prosecution, I submit is fair, and it's in the allocation of the responsibilities and information available to the two parties. It's practical because it complies with the practice of the parties, the Revenue Service and Revenue Canada. It's efficient because it requires the information to be supplied by the party which has best access to that information, and that's the IRS. And it's uniform in that it promotes an identity of approach for the courts to use when they're considering petitions for enforcement of IRS summons, whether they arise in the domestic setting or by means of a request under a treaty.
Mr. Peary, do you know what the what would happen if the situation were reversed and our government was asking Revenue Canada to investigate American accounts up in British Columbia? Would they look at this dichotomy prevalent in the United States between a civil investigation and a criminal one, a criminal referral?
They look at their own, Your Honor.
They look at their own.
I believe the government's brief has pointed that out. That is the actual procedure, and certainly it's reflected in the recent law review article.
And does it parallel ours entirely?
Not entirely, but there is that dichotomy and distinction between prosecution and investigation, and so there's no problem in compliance in Canada with that distinction.
Be true in Pakistan or Philippines.
I would just have to say they have to understand enough about our domestic revenue laws, which control their rights to information under the treaty, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Peary. Mr. Walsh, you have 2 minutes remaining.
If I may refer the court to the pertinent statutes at the end of our brief, pages 2A and 3A. First of all, section 7602B at the bottom of 2A says that a permissible purpose for the issuance of a summons is to get information about a criminal offense. That is not the limitation that Congress has placed. The limitation is in subsection C about Justice Department referrals being in effect. And the line drawn there is not a line about whether a prosecution is pending. It is the question whether Treasury has recommended to Justice that it undertake a grand jury investigation or a prosecution, or whether Justice has requested information from Treasury, regardless of whether a prosecution is actually pending. And the reason for this limitation on the summons enforcement authority was explained by the Senate report in language set forth on page 17 of our brief. It was so as not to broaden the Justice Department's right of criminal discovery or to infringe on the role of the grand jury. It was a reason that had to do with the division of functions between domestic institutions in this country and reflected the language of this Court's LaSalle decision.
Well, but if we adopted that, Mr. Wallace, I assume we would have to adopt B as well. I mean, that is to say, we would not, if we adopted your opponent's argument, we would have to say you also can't use the IRS's power if the foreign country is conducting a criminal investigation, even though there's no criminal prosecution pending. You can't use it for the purpose of inquiring into a criminal offense.
Well, B says you can use it for the purpose of inquiring into a criminal offense, Mr. Justice. Congress specifically authorized the use of an IRS summons for that purpose and put an end to inquiry about whether the IRS had the purpose of inquiring into a criminal defense and instead drew the bright line about whether a referral is in effect.
Thank you, Mr. Wallace. The case is submitted. We'll hear argument next to number